Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Anna Schechtman was 19 when she published her first crossword in the New York Times. And when longtime puzzle editor Will Shortz then asked her to be his assistant, she knew she was entering a male-dominated space. But Schechtman also knew the evolution of the beloved interlocking word grid included many women pioneers. And her new book, part history, part memoir, shares her path to embracing her role in reflecting and defining common knowledge through the crossword. It's called The Riddles of the Sphinx, Inheriting the Feminist History of the Crossword Puzzle. Join us. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Can you think of a seven-letter word for the crossword clue, complex character, with a question mark at the end? If your mind flows to Oedipus, you're probably comfortable in the wonderfully nerdy world of crossword puzzle fanatics. Anna Schechtman has been making crosswords since she was 15, drawn to the idea that through riddles and puns, a crossword puzzle constructor could access, quote, something foundational about language, a quasi-mathematical code that could be rearranged and manipulated through brain power alone. Schechtman now creates puzzles for The New Yorker, and in her new book, The Riddles of the Sphinx, she explores the art, the history, and the politics of crossword making. Anna Schechtman, welcome to Forum.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
So I want to start by talking about what goes into designing a crossword, and that crossword clue, the one that you wrote that I shared at the top, seven letters for complex character, is also one of the ones you open your book with. And I'm wondering if you could break it down for us, what the clue is doing and how someone might approach answering it.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you articulated it with your voice raising at the end, right? Because that's that question mark, which in a crossword clue signals its deception. You know this isn't going to be straightforward or definitional. You're going to have to rely on wordplay and specifically running through or rummaging through all the synonyms and homonyms that could be hidden in the clue. So in this case, a complex character is, you know, a literary character that we typically imagine has sort of conflicting motives and psychological depth. But character could mean all sorts of things, right? So I'm sort of asking the solver to run through all the things that character could mean. It could mean a Chinese character or a letter of the alphabet. It could mean, she was such a character or something like that.
Right.
But it could also mean, right, literary protagonist. Complex, meanwhile, could be, you know, she lived in an apartment complex. It could be sort of a structure. It could be, you know, an adjective. I'll never understand. It's too complex. But in this case, it signals neurosis, right? An Oedipus complex in Oedipus complex, right?
Yep.
So Oedipus is the complex character question mark, right?
And I love the description of how a clue sort of creates problems with language, loosens the word from its common set of associations. And then you have to do this exercise, as you say. But then at the same time, when you get it, there's this sort of like, aha, that was really fun, like the wordplay that was involved in it.
Yeah. That is what I enjoyed most when I started writing crosswords. As you say, accessing something foundational about language. I first started considering writing crossword puzzles and that puzzles were written by people at all when I saw the documentary Wordplay, which maybe some listeners will be familiar with. And there's a C-plot that runs through the film, which is the actual construction of a puzzle by syndicated, brilliant constructor Merle Riegel. And he sits down at his desk, and he seems to have some magical power over language. I truly thought he was a magician. And as a young girl trying to figure out what it almost looked like to be a smart girl, which I wanted to be, I was like, that's what I want to do. I want to be a word magician.
And so we talked about what makes a good clue. In terms of what makes a good answer, a good crossword word, Merle Regel also says, no jargon, no linguistic waste, only good words. So what makes a good crossword word?
Yeah, well, that's actually quite complicated question. And this has actually changed over time. So what Regel is referencing in that, well, two things. He's referencing this idea of crossword-ies, right, which is words we'd find more frequently in crossword puzzles than in everyday speech. And again, frequent solvers will know these words. Ulna, right, which is a bone in the arm. Etui, which is a needle case, right? These are not words that are going to come up in everyday conversation, but they come up in crossword puzzles all the time because we constructors need them. They have great vowels and they really help with our crossings. Although, I try increasingly, not to use them because it's very hard to find fun clues for those words. But he's also referencing this idea of the Sunday morning breakfast test, which was an invention of the first crossword puzzle editor of the New York Times, a woman named Margaret Farrer, who's a fascinating woman who I sort of get into in the history, the sort of feminist history of the book.
Yeah,
I'm happy to talk to you about a lot more about her. But just this idea of the Sunday breakfast test instituted this idea, again, of what a good crossword puzzle word was, is not something that's going to turn the solver's stomach, right? Because we have this image that they're going to be solving the puzzle sort of ritualistically over their meal, right? And so, he says, enema would help me out a million times. Great vowels, right? But we don't really want to see that while we're eating our eggs. So no diseases, maybe no religious dispute or anything that is going to make the solver uncomfortable. That has changed dramatically what that means. I'm happy to get into that.
Yeah. Well, talk a little bit about how that's changed dramatically. What do you mean? Sort of has the purpose of a crossword puzzle changed?
That's right. In some way, I don't know that the purpose has changed, but the politics that have always been there have been surfaced. And there's a million reasons as to why that's happened. But now, when we think about what a good or bad word is, oftentimes we're thinking about representation. And it's a sort of acknowledgement that what the crossword puzzle has always done is patrol the boundaries of common knowledge. So what is common knowledge? It's a really interesting kind of philosophical question and social question.
And who gets to decide?
Who gets to decide, right? So this project, which I hope the politics of that are kind of obvious to everyone, really came to the fore for me when I was Will Schwartz's assistant at the Times. He's the editor of the New York Times crossword puzzle. And our biggest disputes were over this question of common knowledge, common for whom? I wanted to put the term male gaze in a crossword puzzle, and he's like, no one's going to know that, right? And we would have this shorthand, is it a thing? Here we are with highly developed vocabularies, and we're, is it a thing? Our shorthand for should it be in a puzzle or not. Now, of course, I want to say the male gaze is absolutely a thing, and a thing that New York Times solvers should be expected to know. Read any number of Manila Dargis's, film reviews, and you'll see, this idea from the 1970s, a critic named Laura Mulvey, define this idea that films are structured around the male gaze, that the woman's body is represented to be seen by a male viewer. Will didn't think it was puzzle worthy, but this happens all the time in these disputes. And I actually collected a list from friends of mine in the puzzle world. And this is not just about Schwartz at the Times. We were looking at all sorts of mainstream newspapers, and words that editors had decided were not puzzle worthy included matcha tea, Laverne Cox, Marie Kondo, entire puzzle shaped around WNBA teams, right? You can see that a pattern develops, we could say. Yeah. These are words and phrases that have their origins in women's culture, queer culture, Black culture. And I talked quite a bit to Will about this. And I think, this isn't just kind of implicit bias, although it is that too. I know Will wants to delight as many solvers as possible. And so he wants the puzzle to be as sort of democratic as it can be. And he sees these words, sometimes he would use the word niche, which always made me cringe a little bit, I have to say. But what it meant was any word or phrase that's kind of marked by gender or race or sexual orientation, those would be seen as not available to all solvers, right? They were more meant for a subculture. Now, I don't want to see women's culture as a subculture, of course.
Quite a large proportion of the population.
Right, of course. And so, you know, paradoxically, this idea of inclusion or this sort of philosophy of inclusion actually instituted a tacit policy of exclusion.
Right.
And so there's been a lot of efforts, not just by me, of course, but by a lot of constructors who are younger, who are women, who are non-white, who are queer, who have actually kind of made it our business to redefine and reshape the very idea of what's puzzle-worthy by including more words and phrases from our worldviews and our experiences. This can be really frustrating to long-term solvers of the Times puzzle, for whom, you know, this is not just a question of who a puzzle's for, but also what a puzzle's for. If a puzzle's meant to prove to yourself that you're really good at the New York Times crossword puzzle, it can be a real stumbling block to encounter a word or phrase that you don't know and aren't used to seeing in the Times. And so, you know, I could really, you know, stump your solving time or frustrate your streak by including, say, I don't know, Audre Lorde in your puzzle if you don't know her.
Yeah. But you say that things are changing. So what has changed?
Yeah.
Is it the fact that now there are more constructors who are young or represent communities that have not been the gatekeepers of the crossword puzzle,
yeah,
for example? Or do you think there is a certain cultural shift that's happening overall that's even affecting gatekeepers?
Yeah, well, I think so many things. There are a number of factors that have influenced this. One of them is that there are, you know, an influx of new constructors, some of us inspired by wordplay. You know, now almost 10 years ago, right? We're not so young. We're not the vanguard. A lot of new constructors who got excited and inspired by puzzles during COVID. Margaret Farrer used to say that you can't think of your troubles while solving a crossword puzzle, and she started the Times puzzle during World War II. It was very explicitly meant to distract from the anxieties of the war, and I think that got a lot of new solvers involved during the pandemic as well, for similar reasons. I know we were all obsessed with Wordle during the pandemic for that reason. But there, you know, there, I can go on about the number of reasons. I do think it has to do, I think we're much more sensitive to the politics of language and the politics of representation. And seeing the crossword puzzle almost as an Overton window, right? Has this made it into the mainstream? Is that what being puzzle worthy is, a kind of sanctioning? This word should be known. And if you don't know it, look it up.
We're talking about crosswords with Anna Schechtman, who does the crosswords for The New Yorker and is also author of a new book called The Riddles of the Sphinx, Inheriting the Feminist History of the Crossword Puzzle. And we'll have more with her and with you after the break. We want to know, do you do crosswords? Why or why not? You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about crosswords this hour, how they're constructed, what makes for a good clue in an elegant puzzle, the role that crosswords play in society and culture in terms of both forging it and testing it and shaping what should be deemed common knowledge. We're talking with Anna Schechtman, author of The Riddles of the Sphinx, Inheriting the Feminist History of the Crossword Puzzle. She's also an assistant professor in the Department of Literature and English at Cornell University and a crossword constructor for The New Yorker. You, our listeners, are invited to join the conversation. Do you do crosswords? Why or why not? Which ones do you do? Are crosswords a daily ritual for you? What role do they play in your life? Maybe even in your relationships? Is there a memorable crossword clue that you would like to share with us? You can do that at 866-733-6786 by emailing forum@kqed.org or finding us on our social channels. We're at KQED Forum. A listener on Discord writes, I love the crossword. I do the New York Times one every day, and the Sunday crossword is a ritual with the family. It is so satisfying to watch it all come together. I also write trivia and often get inspired by crossword themes and ideas. Such a fun, creative realm. Another listener writes, I'm really grateful for the New York Times mini crossword and daily puzzles like Wordle. My mom and I had a tumultuous relationship when I was younger, and it's sometimes been difficult to connect and talk as adults. We discovered that we both love the mini crossword, and that's made our texting relationship so much easier. Now we send puzzle scores and reactions as a way to say, I'm thinking of you every day, without the loaded emotions. This casual point of contact has led to a happier and more connected relationship overall.
Hear that. I really love to hear that, of course.
Yeah, it's incredible. We're really touching on all the different roles that crosswords actually play in our lives, in our culture, in our relationships as well. It's a pretty incredible thing to think about. And when you were describing sort of the disagreements that you would have with Will Shortz about what made a word puzzle worthy, I'm wondering if you both had a shared sense of who your audience was and what they were using the puzzle for, or if you were able to introduce new ideas about that.
Yeah, Will has actually done an incredible job expanding, or depending on who you ask, right? Expanding the bounds of what is puzzle worthy. If you just look at historical puzzles, there's no pop culture in them whatsoever. There's no brand names. There's no, there's very few proper nouns even. So Will has really introduced a lot of that since his tenure at the Times. And what we're talking about is he's everybody has their worldview and their blind spots. And what's interesting about a puzzle is that it really is an index of the puzzle maker's interests and concerns. And so, they're in addition to there being the New Yorker puzzle and the Times puzzle, there are also a number of puzzle communities that have cropped up in the last few years that are much more narrow or targeted about who their audience is. So there's a group called Queer Crosswords. That's crosswords with a Q. It's hard to get the pun out over radio. Or the Incubator, INKubator, right, which is meant to be training and mentoring women constructors. And I've asked those editors, or is the assumption that these puzzles that are by women for women will have women's language in them? And what is women's language? And they say, yes, that we're often womaning up our clues, right? And if a constructor who doesn't know Bella Abzug learns her in the process, all the better, right? So in that sense, they're sort of pedagogical tool or a form of consciousness raising even.
Yeah. You used to construct your crosswords by hand on graph paper, but you don't do that now. Can you talk about what the process is of making one now using digital tools?
Yeah. So I did used to, when I started out, I really loved the sort of frustrating experience of just trying to get words to intersect on the page, sort of tearing words up into letters and rearranging them or building them back up into recognizable words again. And that's really what the project is when you're constructing them by hand. It's changed dramatically since it's become a digital process or a sort of software-assisted process. And that's happened since the 90s and early aughts. And by the time I was writing crossword puzzles in the early aughts, everyone thought I was a total freak for still doing them by hand. But it's a completely different project when you're using this software, whether it's Crossfire or Crossword Compiler. The work of the computer is now to do that tearing apart of language words into strings of letters. Computers are very good at that, right? We know that from all sorts of sort of natural language processing projects. But since that work is now being done by the computer, the constructor's work is really focused on what we call our word list, a database of words that we rank according to their puzzle worthiness, right? So we're training an algorithm that is quite literally called autofill. We're training an algorithm to say, put this word in a puzzle if you can, don't put this word in a puzzle if you can. And that actually really surfaces all of those questions we were just talking about of what makes a word or phrase puzzle worthy, and the politics of language, right? And so now, especially since we know that algorithms are never neutral, and the word list that most algorithms are trained on initially is the New York Times word list, and I don't know if we've said this yet, but 80%, sometimes 80% plus of crossword puzzles are written by men and by white men, and so those word lists are going to be sort of biased in the direction of words and phrases that white men tend to know. And so oftentimes, I spend a lot of time now retraining the algorithm, which is to say putting words and phrases from women's culture, queer culture into the word list. And then I'm left with these strange questions because I'm not really I'm thinking a lot about training the algorithm and not necessarily the puzzles it's producing. And I'm like, how am I supposed to write an interesting, maybe fun or punny clue for like race science or queer baiting? You know, like, what am I doing? What am I doing? And so I often have to ask whether I'm like actively politicizing a pastime or just bringing to the fore the politics that are inherent in it anyway, as we've been sort of talking about.
And how have you reconciled that, or have you?
Well, it's helpful to think about the work that I'm doing actually in a feminist tradition,
yes.
Right? There's so many women I talk about in the book for whom the politics of language are really what is how they register their feminist politics, whether it's, asking the culture to not use he as the sort of standard generic neutral pronoun, or to say chairperson instead of chairman. The very first woman I write about in the book is this name, Ruth Hale, mm-hmm. who was the president of two leagues. And this is in the 19-teens, the real high time for leagues in American culture. She was the president of what's called the Lucy Stone League, which was advocating for a woman's right to keep her last name. And she was also the president of the Amateur American Crossword Puzzle League, which in fact instituted the rules of the crossword puzzle as we know them today. It should have 360-degree symmetry, no two-letter words. Every letter needs to cross with two separate words. So obviously, her sense of her feminist politics were really registered in language, and she was also completely addicted to crossword puzzles. So it helps when I sort of understand myself as part of this long-standing tradition.
Yeah. You describe the founding editor of the New York Times crossword, Margaret Farrer, as conservative, though, which
That's
I
right.
think is interesting. And there's a point that you make about her that I was really struck by. You observe the crossword as potentially a coping mechanism.
Yeah.
You basically say a way of feeling in control of the culture, even when you've lost it or could never lay claim to it to begin with. Right. So she experiences a great deal of success by adhering to some pretty strict rules and showing herself to be very knowledgeable and so on, things that were valued in the culture at the time. But at the same time, the observation that it's also a coping mechanism when you're sort of trying to succeed in a culture that you probably never had claim to in the beginning made me think a lot about whether you felt this way going through the process of being a young female, crossword constructor.
Yeah, absolutely. There's sort of two traditions that run throughout the book. One is this more conservative tradition of sort of mid-century housewives who were kind of overeducated for their station, right? Margaret Farrer went to Smith College. She was, but then she really identified as a wife and mother, and she didn't actually see herself as a worker, as someone who was producing something valuable. She was just sort of keeping her mind busy. But of course, she was also really attached to this idea that she was a really smart woman. She'd been really educated. And so the crossword puzzle was an outlet for that. It absolutely was for me, too. I think I was, as I say, really trying to, strangely, we started with this idea of a complex character. I think I wanted to be seen as a complex character, someone who had all sorts of psychic depth and interiority and the power to control language in this way appealed to me as a way to signal to the world, yes, I have all this depth and this knowledge about a world that I actually, I was striving to know about.
Yeah.
I can get into that more if you're interested.
Well,
yeah.
You compare the role that crosswords have played in your life to the role that anorexia played in
That's
your
right.
life. What similarities did they share?
Okay, so this is a very strange, peculiar fact of my biography, which in some way was an impetus to write this book, which is almost to the day I started writing crossword puzzles and I stopped eating. And so I wanted to understand their connection. Both seemed to me to be efforts to prove my mental fortitude and to try to lay claim to, or try to master forms that really should be unmasterable, and in fact are unmasterable, let's be really clear about that, to tame both my physical body and the body of language. I also think that they were efforts to almost repudiate being a woman in a way. I think I understood crossword puzzles as signaling and testing a form of knowledge that was sanctioned as worth knowing, but not necessarily a feminist knowledge. As I say, puzzles were the kinds of knowledge that they were testing was informed by what this largely white male group of constructors were determining as puzzle worthy. So I wanted to be legible as smart to men, right? And the book really takes on a sort of a feminist life journey, right? What kinds of forms was I reoccupying to claim my own womanhood? And that meant both reoccupying the form of my body. It's a strange passage in, you know, many chapters of the book about my experience in treatment. Mm-hmm. I assure listeners that it's done with a light touch. But also reoccupy the form of the crossword puzzle and see it as the political object that it always has been.
So what do you love about crosswords now? Because this clearly has had a positive impact in your life.
Sure.
In contrast to your eating disorder. And so what does it bring you now that has made it have staying power for you and continued to be a passion of yours?
Yeah. So, like, I mean, we've been talking about what makes a word or phrase puzzle worthy. And I think it's the sense of recognition. There's something perversely delightful about seeing a word or phrase that appeals to you and feels like it appeals to you as you. Like, this is a puzzle made for me, right? I love I don't know, the Real Housewives series. And I wouldn't expect to see that in a crossword puzzle grid. Something about seeing something that doesn't seem like it maybe deserves space in this pantheon of knowledge, and yet it appeals so much to you that you feel recognized or hailed by the crossword puzzle. It's calling out to you. Mm-hmm. I still love that feeling, and I like producing that feeling for others.
Let me go next to caller Jonathan in Redwood City. Jonathan, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Oh, hi, and great show. I come from the UK. You might be able to tell by my accent, but in the UK, there's a long tradition of cryptic crosswords, which have the kinds of definitions we're talking about in the New York Times, but then add elements like anagrams or complicated things to do with the words to arrive at the answer, and may even have fiendish elements like no grid or, you know, and no length on the answers and things like that. And I'm wondering why that cryptic crossword community exists in the UK but doesn't seem to exist in the US.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. The cryptic crossword, I don't know, this might be apocryphal, but my understanding is that they do publish American-style puzzles in the UK, but they just call them simple puzzles. Maybe that's just feeding into a certain, class resentment or something. I'm not quite sure why they haven't caught on here. There have been various attempts to introduce cryptic puzzles to the U.S., and the caller did an excellent job explaining them. There's really two clues in every clue. One is definitional, and the other is sort of directive. It tells the solver what to do with the clue itself in order to solve it. So that might be right, an anagram, a spoonerism, a deletion, reversing the order of the words. And it really is getting back to that original project that I enjoyed so much, right? Tearing up language and then rearranging it. So I love cryptic crosswords. But the first effort to really bring them to the U.S. was in 1968 when Stephen Sondheim wrote a very impassioned review of cryptic crosswords and rebuke of American-style crosswords, saying that he described the cryptic crossword as a more literary endeavor and having what he called a pseudo-aphoristic grace. I'm not sure why those don't appeal as much to an American sensibility. I will say, and I am log-rolling a bit here, that The New Yorker has introduced cryptic crossword puzzles into, you know, online, and so maybe we can encourage more American solvers to try their hand at the cryptics at thenewyorker.com.
Well, it seems American solvers are very sensitive to the Natick. Do you want to describe what that is and, you know, how you've gotten in trouble with that before?
Oh, yeah. So it's actually, the Natick is something that really is kind of only going to occur in American-style crossword puzzles, actually. It's when you have an intersection of two words that are both understood to be obscure or really unfair, not puzzle-worthy words, so that the solver is left to guess at what that crossing is. It's called a Natick it was named a Natick by the crossword puzzle blogger Rex Parker, who's delightfully ornery, as you would hope a crossword puzzle blogger would be. And I got in trouble it's called a Natick because there was one famous Natick in the Times that included, you know, sixth stop on the Boston Marathon, which is the town of Natick, intersecting with another obscure term. So here we have Natick. I got in trouble at the American Crossword Puzzle Tournament, a speed solving contest where 1,000 people are in a hotel ballroom solving puzzles in less than 5 minutes. So it's a totally insane experience. But I wrote a puzzle for that tournament, and I thought I had an intersection of two very gettable answers. It was one of the girls on Girls, Jessa. This was, I should say,
on the HBO series Girls, which was very popular at the time.
2005, yep. Girls Talk was everywhere, right? And the other one was Backpack Brand, which was JanSport. Now, I thought those were gettable answers, but for many people, many of the solvers, I'd completely sunk their scores because they had to guess Nessa Nansport, Tessa Tansport. And I want to say, you know, when they came up to me and were so mad about this possible Natick, that they weren't just confessing to not watching Girls or not going to, you know, school pickup, but they were confessing to being a man.
We're talking with crossword constructor Anna Scheckman. We'll have more with her and with you after the break. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with crossword constructor for The New Yorker, Anna Scheckman, who's written a new book called The Riddles of the Sphinx, Inheriting the Feminist History of the Crossword Puzzle. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Literature in English at Cornell University. And you, our listeners, are joining the conversation with your thoughts, experiences, and the role that crosswords play in your life. Lori in Sacramento is on the line. Lori, join us.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment about when you were speaking about how certain words could be considered niche because they came from women's interests. It really caused a reaction to me because it brought up how frustrated I get when I do puzzles and there are sports questions, particularly sometimes very esoteric ones, and how now it's occurring to me that that's because things that primarily interest men are not considered niche. It's only things that allegedly primarily interest women that are considered niche.
Lori, thanks for sharing that experience. A listener on Discord writes, I love the idea of writing for the audience you want, trusting the solvers to learn and grow. And then I have these two comments from listeners that I'd love to read back to back. Christina writes, my mom loved to work on crossword puzzles and she would often talk about them. I learned to listen because she always taught me something that would come in handy, like petit pois. I started a college French course with a teacher who was very strict and hard to please. One day she asked in French, what is the little plant that Sartre used to illustrate existentialism? No one raised their hand. I channeled my mom and answered, petit pois. Her whole attitude changed toward me for a much better semester. Scott writes, before I went back to school at 33, I was alienated by clues that made it clear that unless I received a college education, there was no way that I'd be able to engage. I was not invited to the party. I was, however, thrilled when I could use some creativity to answer clues that didn't require specific knowledge, like French for... I want to ask you actually about that. You were talking a little bit earlier about how puzzles can include and exclude. And certainly my immigrant mom never took to crossword puzzles. But you also write about somebody who specifically, this is Portia Lundy, who specifically sort of thinks about what a puzzle can do to draw someone in and include people who may be immigrants or may be not of the, you know, basically idea of what constitutes common knowledge, may not be one of the people defining it.
Yeah. So I should say, there's this interesting gender history of the crossword, right? It was largely women's work and now is largely, I'm one of very few women who write crossword puzzles, but this is a history that's pretty white all the way down. And that's just an interesting question for me. And I've had some wonderful conversations with Portia and also a woman named Soleil Sancir about why that is, about why constructors tend to be white. And what's fascinating and really disturbing about both Soleil Sancir and Portia's history with crossword puzzles is that they were the first two Black women to publish New York Times crossword puzzles. And that happened in 2021. So I was sort of shocked by that statistic. When Portia's story is so phenomenal because she got interested in crossword puzzles on her own with friends. And when she published her Times crossword puzzle, her dad actually told her that when he's from Guyana and he actually ran a crossword puzzle tournament in Guyana. But then when he came to the U.S., never solved any. And this was the first time they even talked about that. And apparently, as she describes it, you know, the knowledge base that was required for American crossword puzzles was not just outside of his knowledge base as an immigrant, but also, of course, made him feel not smart. Because there's something about the crossword puzzle that is meant to be a sort of racially, ethnically unmarked sense of what being smart is. So for her, it was really important that the very first few words in her crossword puzzle were things that she knew would be gettable by her family members. And so I know she had one across was Jada, so Jada Pinkett Smith. She said it's really important for those first few words to be gettable by her family, because if, you know, then they'll carry on. They'll keep solving it. They won't assume that the puzzle itself is telling them that they're not smart.
Well, David writes, please talk about how crossword culture has changed with the advent of online solving.
Yeah. Well, I sort of explained that the process of making puzzles is so different using digitally assisted tools.
And you think that's one of the contributing factors for why it became such a male-dominated space,
yeah,
right?
So on the one hand, you know, the labor force had changed dramatically as women entered it in mass in the 70s and 80s, and then were still expected to do the large share of childcare and housework. Like, when are they going to find time to do this rarefied, not very well-paid puzzle work? But the other real contributing factor to this change in demographics is that the people who got really interested in crossword constructing were interested in it as a natural language processing question. Can computers write puzzles better than people can? And the answer is basically yes. I hate to tell that to you. Although it's still very hard for computers to write clues. ChatGPT does a terrible job writing crossword clues. Although I don't know, give it a few months, right? What is really interesting, and I think the history of computer science bears this out, is that that question, can computers do a job better than people can, so often actually means can computers do a job better than women can, because computers are very good at the kinds of work that women have historically been encouraged to do, whether that's clerical work or actually initially the initial work of programming, of inputting data and cleaning up glitches, and of course also crossword puzzle constructing or weaving with language. And I use that phrase intentionally because it shows how women coded the work used to be.
Yeah. So getting back to David's question how crossword culture has changed with online solving.
Yeah. Well, on the one hand, I do think it has allowed or facilitated a lot more of these sort of indie puzzle markets, right, where a constructor can really be attuned to, I'm a queer constructor and I'm writing for queer solvers. On the other hand, as any solver of who uses a digital, who uses a web app knows, it will also time you. And I think it has really encouraged speed solving. And it will also tell you if you're on a streak. And so, you know, it's funny, I turn off my timer when I solve online. I'm pretty good at solving crossword puzzles. I should be, right? But my sense is that they're really there to waste time, not beat it. But I do think it's really encouraged this sort of sense of competitiveness with oneself. You want to get a faster time than you had before. And I'm always so interested in what it is about this particular kind of work that feels like it's not work, or what's so appealing about doing this particular kind of intellectual labor. Maybe it's because it's discreet, and like so much else in our life that's just endless ongoing work, it feels really good to just finish something and to kind of put your intelligence to something that can be tested but then solved, right? What a great thing. What if there were more solutions in this world as opposed to open questions?
Well, Jane writes, it's great to hear Anna Shechtman. I'm a non-white woman, but to heck with politics, representation, and speed, I have certain language problems and do crosswords slowly because that's the way I like to do them, tripping over words because they induce reveries, and it's delicious. That's also what happens when I read even a paragraph of Anna Shechtman. I call this the Empedoclean method, stepping from summit to summit, not to travel only one path of words to the end.
Wow. That's just wonderful. Thank you so much for that.
Yeah. So what role do you think crosswords play in our society and culture today? And then you could also add what role you think it should play.
Yeah. So, you know, I do see crossword puzzles as, you know, a way to waste time, but still engage your mind. But also as a pedagogical tool, as a way to teach. You know, I am a professor, right? And I've also have learned so much from crossword puzzles. When I got started solving them as a teenager, I used to solve them with my mom. And I was pretty good at the wordplay stuff, but I was super ignorant about just about everything else. And so, you know, it did create a sort of bond between us that she could teach me so much about, you know, American history, or, you know, as the other caller said, 70s sports stars, right? Or what we might call niche knowledge, right? But, you know, again, there's an interesting history to this. There's a woman in my book named Julia Penelope, and she was a linguist and English professor, and she actually taught some of the very first women's literature courses in this country. And she also wrote lesbian separatist crossword puzzles. And they were filled with words and phrases both from the lesbian separatist movement and the women's movement, and also words and phrases from these separatist dictionaries that were meant to be creating a new idiom for women. This idea that language has been shaped by men, let's write it anew for women. But the paradox of her puzzles, they were kind of meant to be consciousness-raising devices. And I'm very, you know, that kind of appeals to me, too, to use a crossword puzzle as a consciousness-raising device. But you really couldn't solve her puzzle if your feminist consciousness wasn't already raised, right? They're full of footnotes, actually, because she does want you to go, like, look up the figures that she's drawing on and these very interesting now historical artifacts of kind of lost histories of women's language and mythological figures of a lost past before patriarchy, right? I think they're beautiful documents, but, you know, I don't think that they would be accepted by Will Shorts at the time.
Well, it's that constant struggle of, as you say, introducing new ideas, right? And maybe the crossword as a classroom to some extent, but also you don't want to lose people in the process.
Of course you don't want to lose people, yeah. And for those of, for those who are using it to test their solving time and their speed every day, then you really will lose people. And it's funny, I've been often told that my puzzles contain too much trivia, and I find that's so peculiar, because it is a game about trivia. It's a trivia game in a way. I think what they mean is that I include too many words and phrases that they don't know and also don't necessarily care about. And so my puzzles seem trivial to them, or it's a way to trivialize my puzzles. One way I like to redirect that is to think about the initial root of the word trivia, right? So I'm going to get really word nerdy on you. But it comes from the trivium, right? Which was the sort of lower levels of education in medieval education system, including grammar, rhetoric, dialectics, argument, all of the things that make us good with language, right? So, sure, they're trivia, but they're educating us in rhetoric, in dialectics, right? They're educating us in how to use language and how to use language persuasively.
Yeah. Let me remind listeners, you're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. I'm struck by how you've been asked by solvers or even editors sometimes to remove words like NRA, or some editors will never have Trump or Biden. And you had a solver who didn't like that. An answer was Alito, because they essentially were using the crossword to distract themselves from the Trump administration at the time. This was when Trump was president. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, At first I was really resistant to removing those words from the puzzle. And I do think it's a sort of transformation of that Sunday morning breakfast test, right? Now it's not just words or phrases that relate to the body or to diseases. It's now words that turn your stomach for other reasons. And I have a friend who won't even put Trump in a puzzle if it's clued as a verb. She just doesn't want to see the letters strung together. I think I do understand that, in part because, well, first of all, software-assisted constructing is so sophisticated that, you know, it is actually quite easy to remove these words from your word database. I think when I was still constructing by hand, I would think, Alito, what great vowels. I need those. I can't take those out. But now, because I use the software, it is pretty easy, actually, to take those words out of my word list, out of my word database. And it's interesting to think of it as a kind of almost platforming, right? Is it an endorsement to put a word or phrase in your crossword puzzle? I almost wonder, like, one day will they be selling these little white squares as ad space, right? Because there is something, once you've found yourself in a crossword puzzle, you've made it, right? There is something you're being included in some sort of, or enshrined in some sort of a pantheon of worth knowing. And so maybe it's totally legitimate to say, you know, how am I going to write a clue for Alito? He wrote the Dobbs decision. That's going to turn my stomach over breakfast.
Well, Paul writes, I know the Times gets hundreds of submissions. Someday I'd like to join the pack. Can you briefly explain the process and criteria? I'm mostly a dedicated solver, but I've constructed a few puzzles in the past. So someone who's interested in being a constructor, any tips?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's see where to start. And it's true. Will Shortz gets hundreds of submissions, and he used to get them in the mail when I worked for him. And, you know, so we would have a big Santa Claus sack that came up from the Times offices to his home office, and we would go through them and reject basically all of them. I mean, his acceptance rate is lower than Harvard's, but at this point, it is thankfully you can now submit them online. But I would really encourage you to download one of these constructing software programs, whether it's Crossfire or Crossword Compiler. And it used to be you'd have to spend quite a bit of money to get these word lists, but now there's some incredible open source word lists. I highly recommend something called Spread the Word List, and it's by constructors Brooke Husick and Enrique Anguiano, and they've taken the Times crossword puzzle word list, and they've actually sort of scrubbed it of all the words and phrases that they would find distasteful. But they haven't removed them entirely. They've just ranked them as zero. So you can go back in and opt in and say, you know, I like Kanye West. I'm going to put him in my puzzle, even if many people wouldn't want to see him in their crossword puzzle. And then, you know, this is the inverse of cryptic crosswords for those British solvers out there. But you figure out what words and phrases you want to put in initially. You put them in, you put in your block squares, and then, I gotta say it, you autofill.
Well, Sue writes, I am 75 years old and started doing crosswords in high school. I give this lifelong love of puzzles the credit for getting me started as a computer programmer in 1969. And I've been a techie ever since, solving the puzzle of making computers do things to help people. We just have about 30 seconds left, but with the fact that puzzles are online, where do you see it going? Like, what kinds of possibilities do you envision for the crossword? 3D, like more complicated?
Yeah. Well, it is designs. Much easier to actually think of really fast, great themes with things like, regex or regional expression, right? They help you. That's already putting words into strings of letters. So great tool for us. But right now, crossword puzzler, there are apps that can solve crossword puzzles faster than humans can. What if we have crossword puzzles or apps that can create puzzles better than humans can? There's some kind of dystopian future out there where we'll have a computer making a crossword puzzle and then solving it really quickly. I know there are more dystopian, world futures out there, but that might be one of them.
Well, in the meantime, we'll get back to its core with words. Really appreciated hearing yours today, Anna Shechtman. Thanks so much for being with
us. Thank you.
The book is The Riddles of the Sphinx, and you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.